today's title, A Man's Foes Shall Be Those of His Own Household.
We come now, brothers and sisters, to what really is the end of the first phase, which we've described in the earlier course of the week as that phase relating to David being a fugitive from the hand of Saul. If you take a look at your chart, the white one, we are looking at that slope, downward slope, that leads from the time when David was in the court of Saul. We have passed the time when he feigned madness before Achish, the time at Nob where Saul slew the priests, the period in which he was in the cave. We're coming close to the time when Samuel is about to die, and very close to what really is the bottom point of that slope. So we will begin on that slope, about three quarters of the way down, and then we will deal briefly with a summary on that, and then proceed a little bit after the time of David's sin with Bathsheba. And that will be really the focus of most of our comments this morning. Now, we just say that by way of introduction so you can plot roughly where we are. We're not at all points mentioning the Psalms, which have a bearing on these various periods. And I hope that you take the time, perhaps when you get home, to write in the margin in Samuel those Psalms which we can be fairly sure of as they relate to the various events. I think you'll find that helpful to turn to one of the events in David's life and then also to look up a Psalm that expresses his feelings as he reflects upon those events. I'd like to open our Bibles this morning at 1 Samuel chapter 26. This means that we are now past the time of Samuel's death, which is charted there for you on the slope. David is coming very close to the end of his first phase as a fugitive. Verse 1. And the Ziphites came unto Saul to Gibeah, saying, Doth not David hide himself in the hill of Hakkelah, which is before Jeshimon? And Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having 3,000 chosen men of Israel with him, to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul, verse 3, pitched in the hill of Hakkelah, which is before Jeshimon by the way. But David abode in the wilderness, and he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness. No doubt, these verses imply that not only did Saul have some kind of effective spy network, but David himself obviously had some kind of an intelligence force that informed him of what Saul's movements were. Now we come face to face, Saul and David, one of the closest contacts they have with each other during these years. Verse 5, David arose and came to the place where Saul had pitched. And David beheld the place where Saul lay, and Abner, the son of Ner, the captain of his hosts, and Saul lay in the trench, and the people pitched round about him. Then answered David and said to Ahimelech the Hittite, and to Abishai the son of Zeruiah, brother to Joab, saying, Who will go down with me to Saul to the camp? And Abishai said, I will go down with thee. So David and Abishai came to the people by night. And behold, Saul lay sleeping within the trench, and his spear struck in the ground at his bolster. But Abner and the people lay round about him. Then said Abishai to David, God hath delivered thine enemy into thine hand this day. Now therefore, let me smite him, I pray thee, with the spear even to the earth at once, and I will not smite him the second time. And David said to Abishai, Destroy him not, for who can stretch forth his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? The incident is revealing, isn't it, brothers and sisters? Here was David's golden opportunity, we would say, to take the law into his own hands. David had fled from this man for a long time. This man had been the cause of David's distress for many, many weeks and months. Here was the man right before him who had caused all the discomfort and the agitation in David's life. Had he been a man who thought according to an earthly man, David would have given in to the suggestions or the pressure that he slay Saul right here and then. But David didn't. And surely we have here, brothers and sisters, an important insight into the heart of David. Despite his frustration and his weariness as a fugitive, David was merciful to Saul. We'll see that this is extremely important in David's experience, that God has promised that he will be merciful to those who show mercy. With what measure, we're told, with what measure we mete out judgment or mercy, it shall be meted out to us. And David no doubt understood that divine principle, that on the basis by which he would judge Saul, or by which he would extend mercy, he, David, would be judged, and he, David, would receive mercy from God's hand. It was surely a large part of the explanation as to how it was that God could extend the mercy and the patience he did to David when David sinned with Bathsheba and murdered Uriah. Mercy was extended to David, but David had extended mercy to Saul. David had exercised restraint at a time when most of us would not have exercised restraint, especially since he was being pressured here by powerful suggestion from those who had come with him. We see, brothers and sisters, as we just proceed here to verse 10, that David defers to providence. Read in verse 10, David answers the suggestion of his men by the following reply. David said furthermore, "As the Lord liveth, as the Lord liveth, the Lord shall smite him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall descend into battle and perish." See how David is looking at the situation? He considers at least three alternatives. At this point, David obviously then is deferring to providence. He believed, obviously, that God would handle the situation. It was God's prerogative to deal with Saul. It's really a New Testament principle as well, isn't it? "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, and I will repay." Paul expresses that very clearly in Romans. "Vengeance is mine, I will repay." It's easy, in doing the readings, to gloss over these sections and not give them their due weight. What would it have been like to have been David in that circumstance? What kind of temptation was placed before David? A very real temptation. He must have had itchy fingers, and so must have his men. Very, very tempting indeed. But he deferred. He placed it all in the hands of God. He would not take the law into his own hands, although at times in the past he had done so. And God, no doubt, brothers and sisters, remembered him for that. And let us remember that basic principle ourselves, that the judgment and the mercy that we mete out will be the measuring stick by which the Almighty will mete out judgment and mercy to us. And so, David passes over this so-called golden opportunity. A little further down, though, in this chapter, we notice that before this situation is completely finished, there is a dialogue between David and Saul. David senses that Abner is not looking after the Lord's anointed. And that becomes a primary concern in David's dialogue with Saul. He goes out of his way, in fact, to warn Saul that those who are his men close to him, like Abner, are not as loyal as Saul perceives. Verse 14, David cried to the people, and to Abner the son of Ner, saying, "Answerest thou not Abner?" Then Abner answered and said, "Who art thou that criest to the king?" And David said to Abner, "Art not thou a valiant man? And who is like to thee in Israel? Wherefore then hast thou not kept the Lord the king? For there came one of the people in to destroy the king thy Lord." Speaking of himself. Verse 16, "This thing is not good that thou hast done. As the Lord liveth, ye are worthy to die, because ye have not kept your master the Lord's anointed." David then challenges Abner's loyalty. He questions his motives, and in doing so, he is also warning Saul. So much was David's respect for Saul, so much was David's loyalty to the Lord's anointed, that David could indirectly desire to bless his enemies and not to rail against Saul. He was really warning his enemy of those who were around him. That was the heart of David at its best, willing to bless and curse not, wishing the best for Saul, and even trying to warn Saul of the disloyalty that obviously was surrounding him at the time. Of course, later on, Abner proves himself, ultimately, to be a very ambitious and self-centered man in his aborted revolt later on. David obviously then read Abner's heart, and he knew that Abner was not truly being loyal to Saul. But the fact to note is, as we've said, the kind of concern David still has for his enemies. It's very much like what Bob was mentioning the other day, praying for those who persecute us, praying for our enemies. It's hard to do, but David did it. And in so doing, it helped, no doubt, that he later on should receive mercy and kindness from the Lord when David was to fail. We're perhaps surprised to read, when we come down to chapter 27, verse 1, that David, following this dialogue with Saul, begins once again to slip into depression. It's a marvelous insight into the humanness of David. Verse 1 of chapter 27, "And David said in his heart, I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than that I should speedily escape into the land of the Philistines." Really, David? What a statement. There is nothing better for me than that I should speedily escape into the land of the Philistines. "And Saul shall despair of me to seek me any more in any coast of Israel. So shall I escape out of his hand." You notice how David, once again, considers going back into the land of the Philistines, which had caused him so much trouble previously. Now, though, as we've said during our question period, there was good that came out of this, David was not thinking wisely here. Do you know, it's comforting to realize that David repeated his errors more than once. There are times in our experience when we are aware that we have been to this place once again. We have repeated a sin. We have failed along the same lines more than once. And, no doubt, we feel very frustrated. And perhaps we feel despair. At those moments, we don't need to excuse ourselves, but we need to remember that there's no need for total despair because we have failed more than once. David repeated his failures time and again. Just notice now how this pattern that we have seen in the past begins to follow the same course. First, as in the past, he has been in contact with Saul. And in the past, it was following his contact with Saul and his fear of Saul that made him flee, first to Samuel, then to Jonathan, and then finally flee to Gath. Here, too, he has been in dialogue just previous to Saul. It would appear that David was really very strong in his faith when he deferred to providence, when he refused to smite Saul. But following that incident, David slips into despair. And like in the past, in his despair, he considers removing himself from where Gad the seer said he should be. He considers removing himself from Judah and placing himself in the world, as it were, in the land of the Philistines. Now just notice what David then does. Verse 2 of chapter 27, "David arose and he passed over with the 600 men that were with him unto Achish, the son of Maoch, king of Gath." And verse 3, "David dwelt with Achish at Gath, he and his men, every man with his household, even David with his two wives." David then is allowed, as we read the account in verse 6, to dwell in a town just a little below Gath, in the town of Ziklag. It was somewhat out of sight of Gath. It allowed David a certain amount of independence, although he was within the borders of the Philistines. Verse 7, and the time that David dwelt in the country of the Philistines was a full year and 4 months. During this time, David's behavior is interesting to note. Verse 8, David and his men went up and invaded the Geshurites and the Gezerites and the Amalekites, for those nations were of old. For those nations were of old the inhabitants of the land, as thou goest to Shur, even unto the land of Egypt. And David smote the land, and left neither man nor woman alive, and took away the sheep, and the oxen, and the asses, and the camels, and the apparel, and returned and came to Achish. Now notice the next parallel to these periods of difficulty in David's life. For once again, David resorts to deception. Verse 10. Achish said, whither have ye made a road today? And David said, against the south of Judah, and against the south of the Jerahmeelites, and against the south of the Kenites. And David saved neither man nor woman alive to bring tidings to Gath, saying, lest they should tell on us, saying, so did David, and so will be his manner all the while he dwelleth in the country of the Philistines. And Achish believed David, saying, he hath made his people Israel utterly to abhor him. Therefore he shall be my servant forever. Frustration and despair, as a result of his situation with Saul, he contemplates it, he slips further into depression, he considers leaving the area of activity which God really had intended him to work in, and back he goes to Gath, out into the world, removing himself from the immediate activities you'll work, we could say, and in doing so, he lives with the Philistines. And while he's there, he falls once again to deception or to guile. That's exactly the pattern we've seen previously. First, his consideration of Saul's strength, then his sense of despair, fleeing first to Samuel, then to Jonathan, finally to Gath, and in Gath, resorting to deception or guile. You see, brothers and sisters, David had been here before. And so have we, so often, when we fail. We are often aware of repeated errors. Let us take heart, brothers and sisters, that although we often slip on the same stone, although we often repeat the same mistake, there is no reason to feel total despair by any means. God knows our weakness. He worked with men as great as David, who slipped again and again and fell into the same type of pattern. Each time, perhaps, David learned a little bit more. Just hold your hand here and turn to the Psalm 119. This is looking at our difficulties and our failures from a positive note. It's, as we've said, not to excuse ourselves for repeated mistakes and errors, but it's to dissuade us from total despair. We don't need to feel that because we haven't learned the lesson the first time, that God is frustrated with us. Psalm 119 expresses it this way. Verse 65. Thou hast dealt with me, thou hast dealt well with thy servant, O Lord, according unto thy word. Teach me good judgment and knowledge, for I have believed thy commandments. Before I was afflicted, I went astray. But now have I kept thy word. You see the psalmist's perspective concerning affliction? He believes that before he was afflicted, he went astray. But as a result of being afflicted, he has learned something. In other words, having come through the affliction, the trial, the test, or his own personal failing, he has come through that having learned something. He has learned more fully how to keep God's word. There's a positive outlook towards trial and difficulty. And verse 71, it is good for me that I have been afflicted, that I might learn thy statutes. Yes, David failed more than once. And on the same type of mistake, with the same lack of proper outlook. But through each circumstance of trial, David did learn something, as the psalmist proclaims. He learned something, no doubt, about himself. He learned something also about his Maker. And isn't that really the heart of the issue? When we fail, or when we are going through a difficult trial and sense that we're not really up to what we should be to meet it, when we have doubts, when it generates within us a sense of inadequacy, during the middle of the trial, it's perhaps very difficult to see its value. But even if we have failed during that trial, we learn two things. A, we learn something about ourselves, and B, we learn something about our Maker. We learn something about our Maker in the sense that we learn that He still is patient, that we can still go back to Him and beg for forgiveness. We learn that He is merciful, long-suffering, as Moses was told, and patient. And we learn something about ourselves. We learn how weak we are. We learn how much more we have yet to learn. We learn humility. And these circumstances did bring humility to David. The greatest of all of David's failures, the sin with Bathsheba, was the one incident in David's life that brought him to the fullest amount of humility. There was some good that came out of that. It molded David's heart. It changed his attitude towards himself. So, brothers and sisters, let us take heart as we read these events in David's life. And let us not think that David only repeated a mistake, or rather only fell to a mistake once and then learned the lesson. That was not so. And let us not view David as though he did not have these slips in his life and human weaknesses, very glaring at times. Well, David, of course, finds himself in a very difficult spot. For later on in these chapters, we can see, as we go over to chapter 27, and then into chapter 28, going further on into chapter 29, that as this year and some months pass, David involves himself in the war plans with the Philistines. And as we come to chapter 29, verse 1, we read the Philistines gathered together all their armies to Aphek, and the Israelites pitched by a fountain which is in Jezreel. And the lords of the Philistines passed on by hundreds and by thousands, but David and his men passed on in their rearward with Achish. David is going out to fight Israel. David is going to be fighting with the Philistines. And of course, through God's providential response to David's circumstance, the Philistines are used by God to remove David from the circumstance. So, we read in verse 11 of chapter 29, David and his men rose up early to depart in the morning to return into the land of the Philistines, and the Philistines went up to Jezreel. In other words, the Philistines decided finally to remove David from their ranks to allow him to go back. In going back and in being providentially delivered from having to fight against his own people, David then in chapter 30 is brought once again back into the realm of activity where he belongs. Here in chapter 30, we read, verse 1, "It came to pass, when David and his men were come to Ziklag, on the third day, that the Amalekites had invaded the south, and Ziklag and burned it with fire. While David had been away from this Philistine recluse, there had been an invasion. David and his men lost their families." We come to verse 3. "David and his men came to the city, and behold, it was burned with fire, and their wives and their sons and their daughters were taken captives. Then David and the people that were with him lifted up their voice and wept until they had no more power to weep. And David's two wives were taken captives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail the wife of Nabal the Carmelite. And David was greatly distressed, for the people spake of stoning him. because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his sons and for his daughters. The pressure on David was enormous. Having lost, it would have seemed, their families and their main camp while they were away, hoping to support the Philistines, tragedy struck. And upon returning, David's men now are pressing down on him. And in this crisis, David reveals his true faithfulness to God. Under the pressure of the circumstances, being close to being stoned by his own people, look at verse 6 at the end. But David encouraged himself in the Lord his God. And once again, according to verse 7, he solicits the help of Abiathar the priest, and he consults God through the ephod and asks for direction. There, brothers and sisters, David begins to emerge from his depression. But what were the circumstances that assisted David? First, he was now no longer working closely with the Philistines. In a series of steps, ever so gradual, through God's help, he was removing himself with the alliance with the world. And once that alliance began to be severed, David once again returned to his proper senses. It was in cutting himself off from allegiance with the world and with Achish that provided the right setting for David to think clearly and to think spiritually. You see the point, brothers and sisters. It's very practical in its application to all of us. When we are in loyalty with the world, when we walk with the world, with the Philistines, when the Achishes and the Philistines are our friends, we're not likely to make the right kind of decisions. Friendship with the world is enmity with God. And the closer we are friends with the world, the less likely we are to discern spiritually. It was when David, through God's help, distanced himself from the Philistines and from his involvement with their campaign that once again he turned his heart to the ecclesia, little as it was that was gathered around him. And in great distress, David falls back, as he should, upon God. He encouraged himself in the Lord his God. You see the key to success in trial. We must, brothers and sisters, do what David did. In our distresses, when we sense that perhaps all the world is blaming us, or when we sense that we have slipped badly, we need to turn to the pages of the Word and get the strength we need. The Psalms are helpful. The Proverbs have wise and profound guidance during times of trial. But the whole counsel of Scripture is useful. How encouraging it is during times of trial to turn up the life of David and perhaps spend several days reading the life of David or part of it, as we have this week, or soliciting the help of the Psalms to give us encouragement as David needed encouragement. Let us find what were his keys to success in stress and difficulty, and despite our repeated failure, not to slip into total despair. David didn't, and we do not need to either. Well, as we proceed through this account, the tide begins to turn fully. And of course, David is about then to move on to greater things. We're going to skip over a few chapters here, which of course bring us into the second book of Samuel, where David is about to set up his capital in Hebron. If you take a look at your sheet, we're really at the bottom of that first large valley where depression is marked. And for the sake of saving some time, without having to read all the parts of the narrative, just look at that sheet once again, and we can see what the main events are that transpire at this point. We've mentioned his depression, found almost at the bottom of that valley, chapter 27, verse 1. Shortly after this, and while David is in Ziklag, returning his fortunes, of course, Saul and Jonathan finally fall. The mighty lose their lives. Abner's revolt begins in 1 Kings chapter 2. But during that period of civil war, David is recognized by Judah, sets himself up as king in Hebron, and following that, about a 7-year period, the fortunes begin to change, and David once again begins to ascend in his importance and in his place amongst his people. He is crowned king. He takes the Jebusites, or Zion, in the series of two steps. The ark is finally brought to Zion, and in 2 Samuel chapter 7, the covenant is given to David. He effects victories over his enemies. Then, not long after that, at the pinnacle of his power and strength, David falls once again in his terrible sin with Bathsheba and in his murder of Uriah. By the way, Uriah should have one R there. That's the Scotch spelling of Uriah. Our typist added an extra R, so if you would like to correct that. Think, though, brothers and sisters, of what that diagram charts for you. Once again, David falls. This time, it's his greatest tragedy. David is a man with clay feet, just like you and I. He learned lessons. He could say that he was glad that he was afflicted, like the psalmist. He could say that he learned lessons from his afflictions. But here, at a latter point in David's life, not an early point, but after some years of experience, it's then that David has his greatest fall. No need for total despair. No need for suicidal feelings within ourselves when we fail so miserably at times. David was humbled. David learned lessons. David lived with the consequences of his sin with Bathsheba and his murder of Uriah. But David could still be described afterwards as a man after God's own heart. Think of that, brothers and sisters. Here we have followed David, briefly, through these periods of his life over the course of this past week. We've seen David at strong points, and we've seen him in total despair. Do you feel depressed at times? David felt depressed. Repeating his errors and then committing one, as is the sin with Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah, that was more heinous than any of the others he had committed. And yet, David was a man after God's own heart. And that was said of David even in the New Testament, long after David's death. You see, there were things in David, despite his failings and despite his weaknesses, that attracted God to him. In the overall picture, David deserved that epithet, that he was a man after God's own heart. It doesn't mean that he conquered all the time. It doesn't mean that he wasn't given to failure and repeated failure at that. It means that in the overall, God's estimation of David was that his heart was in tune with the Maker. I'd like now, brothers and sisters, to look especially at the section dealing with Absalom's revolt and David's fleeing Jerusalem. Now you can see that, of course, by those last three or four dots on the final decline over to the right-hand side of the chart. That's the area that I'd like to concentrate on in the remainder of our period this morning. Now, the green sheet which we've given you is just another way of approaching the structure of this period. You can take a quick glance at that. Let's look at it together before we just move on to the next section. It charts out, really, the structure of 2 Samuel. It shows you that David's sin falls roughly in the middle of the book. David's triumphs lead up to his great sin with Bathsheba in chapters 11 and 12 of 2 Samuel. You can see that after that, there's a chart section there showing his troubled period where a man's foes were those of his own household. You can see that going down below, in the bottom section of the chart, how it subdivides and retitles the sections. The 7.5 years of David in Hebron. The 33 years covered while David is then king in Jerusalem. Well, that perhaps helps to picture where we are in David's life and make some sense of the various events in this second phase of David's experience. So we have now crossed the watershed of David's life. From this point, all experiences in David's life find their source in that one event listed on your green sheet. It is in the middle. From this point, all experiences find their source, the sin with Bathsheba. One event which explains all the events that transpire in the second part of 2 Samuel. Most of the events, then, in that second part of the book are drawn out of and absolutely tied in with his great sin with Bathsheba. And thus, the structure is interesting to note, that it is right in the middle of the book. Despite, though, the depth of this tragic event, brothers and sisters, God did not allow David to collapse in total despair. How not? First, he assured David, once he confessed, that his sins were forgiven. Secondly, let's turn to 2 Samuel chapter 12, after his sin with Bathsheba, and after his confession. 2 Samuel chapter 12, verse 24. God does not allow David to collapse in total despair. Verse 24, and David comforted Bathsheba his wife, and went in unto her, and lay with her, and she bare a son. And he called his name Solomon, and the Lord loved him. Encouragement. Even the name Solomon itself breathed hope and expectation on a positive note. Here was the woman with whom he had committed such a sad deed. And yet, it is from the marriage of these two that Solomon comes, and his name meant peace. It promised David of something greater in the future. Verse 25, there's further encouragement. For along comes Nathan the prophet, the one who had pronounced David's error, is the one now who offers encouragement. Verse 25, and he sent by the hand of Nathan the prophet, and called his name Jedidiah, because of the Lord. And the margin shows you, his name meant beloved of the Lord. And Joab fought against Rabbah of the children of Ammon, and took the royal city. And Joab sent messengers to David and said, I have fought against Rabbah, and have taken the city of waters. Now therefore, gather the rest of the people together, and encamp against the city, and take it, lest I take the city, and it be called after my name. And David gathered all the people together, and went to Rabbah, and fought against it, and took it. And he took their king's crown from off his head, the weight whereof was a talent of gold with the precious stones, and it was set on David's head, and he brought forth the spoil of the city in great abundance. Can you see David standing there with the crown of gold from his enemies now placed upon his head? Here, brothers and sisters, following in the wake of his sin with Bathsheba and his murder of Uriah, was a token of blessing. Here was a token, brothers and sisters, that encouraged David. Victory was now soon to be totally within his grasp. And despite his failure, David now encourages David, and he dissuades him from total despair. First, by the positive announcement from Nathan, and from the naming of the son, words prophetic of encouragement. And then secondly, the crowning on David's head. It was not God's intention to leave David totally in the valley. And so, brothers and sisters, God works with us. He wishes us to be humble. He seeks our confession and our repentance. And as John the Baptist beckoned, we must come forward with fruits that are meet or worthy of repentance. But he does provide us with encouragement. He doesn't wish to encourage within us suicidal feelings, like that which Judas had. Learn our lessons we must, but fall to total despair is not God's intent. Now, brothers and sisters, we proceed a little further in this account. David is faced sooner or later with rebellion within his own home. Through this work of Absalom, David's power and strength in the court is undone. Let's just go a little further here. 2 Samuel chapter 15, This is the chapter which describes Absalom's rebellion. In the first few verses of chapter 15, we read how Absalom began to win the hearts of the people over to himself. David's hands seem to be tied. And of course, Joab begins to usurp his authority over David. You notice how brusquely Joab delivered his message to David that we just read about. How he virtually commanded David to come to the city and take his part as the king. That's a clue. From that point on, Joab virtually dictates to David what shall be done. And David's hands are tied because of his sin. Absalom works intrigue within the court. He wins over David's closest friend, Ahithophel. And together, they spin a web around David. David senses that his time is up. Just look at 2 Samuel chapter 15. Verse 10. Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, "As soon as ye hear the sound of the trumpet, then ye shall say, Absalom reigneth in Hebron." And with Absalom went 200 men out of Jerusalem that was called, and they went in their simplicity, and they knew not anything. And Absalom sent for Ahithophel the Gileonite, and David's counselor from his city, even from Gilah, while he offered sacrifices. And the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. And there came a messenger to David, saying, "The hearts of the men of Israel are after Absalom." Does David fight? Does he resist? Look at verse 14. How quickly David acquiesces. "And David said unto all his servants that were with him at Jerusalem, Arise, and let us flee, and we shall not else escape from Absalom. Make speed to depart, lest he take us suddenly and bring evil upon us, and smite the city with the edge of the sword." This isn't the David who, when a messenger came to him and told him that Nabal, the churlish man, had resisted David's overtures for help, girded on his sword and his armor, and took his men, and were about to snuff out Nabal and his farming area. No, this is a different David. Here, David seems to be resigned. He has a much greater attitude of patience and acceptance of his fate. There's been a change in David. No doubt he's been humbled by his experience and his failure with Uriah and Bathsheba. But David is resigned to accept the circumstances of life in a way that wasn't true previously. When David then flees from Jerusalem, notice the expression that is used to describe how he leaves and where he goes. Follows. And in doing so, just look at verse 23. "And all the country wept with a loud voice. And all the people passed over. The king also himself passed over the brook Kidron. And all the people passed over towards the way of the wilderness." The way of the wilderness. David is once again back into the condition of being a fugitive. But brothers and sisters, it is in the wilderness. We think of the early verses we read at the beginning of the week. It is in the wilderness that God works with men and women. It is in the wilderness that he tries the hearts. It was in the wilderness that Jesus Christ was sent by the Spirit in order to be tempted and tried and to know what was in his heart. As Deuteronomy 8 tells us, the people of Israel were brought to the wilderness to humble them, to prove them, and to know what was in their heart. David returns then to the same place he often spent in the past. It's a slightly different area in terms of geography, but it's the same kind of environment. It's a wilderness. Many a man, brothers and sisters, has found God in the wilderness when he had lost him in the city. And in some ways, God had been lost to David in the city. But David is going to find God in the wilderness in a way that perhaps he had never found him before. David, verse 30, climbs the Mount of Olives. "And he wept as he went up, and he had his head covered and went barefoot, with all the people that was with him, covered every man his head, And they went up, weeping as they went up. And one told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Lord, I pray thee, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. Notice that scene. David prays as he flees. He is still a man of prayer, accepting his fate and not resisting as he had done previously. David worships, or he prays, as he flees. Do you? Do I? What a comment on the spirituality of David despite his difficulties. Verse 32, it came to pass that when David was come to the top of the mount, notice this, where he worshipped God, behold, Hushai the Archite came to meet him with his coat rent and earth upon his head. Who was Hushai? Well, the chapters show us. Hushai is about to become David's fifth columnist in Jerusalem. Hushai will go back to Jerusalem and act as a spy for David. Hushai is going to be the man who will overthrow the council of Ahithophel and return the fortunes to David. David admonishes him in the verses that follow and into the next chapter to go back to Jerusalem and remain in Jerusalem where he can do some good. Look at what God is doing with David. David prays first in verse 31 once he receives the bad news. He prays and he asks the Father, Lord, I pray thee, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. And as soon as David gets to the top of the Mount of Olives, the prayer is answered. Hushai appears to David, the man in whom David will invest his fullest trust to go back to Jerusalem and undermine the council of the conspirators. What a tremendous force of encouragement for David. What an answer to prayer. Unexpectedly, there's the man right when David appears at the top of the mount. So David encourages his men, and God encourages David and answers his prayer to overthrow the council of the wicked. David, of course, loses his son. Absalom falls finally in the final battle. I want you just to go over, brothers and sisters, as we close, to 2 Samuel, chapter 19. We go over a number of the events that transpire at this time as they revolve around, finally, the death of Absalom and the conspirators. In 2 Samuel chapter 19, let's go down to verse 9. And all the people were at strife throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, The king saved us out of the hand of our enemies, and he delivered us out of the hand of the Philistines, and now he has fled out of the land for Absalom. Verse 11, King David sent to Zadok and to Abiathar the priest, saying, Speak unto the elders of Judah, saying, Why are ye the last to bring the king back to his house, seeing the speech of all Israel has come to the king, even to his house? You see now, the tide is beginning to change. Down to verse 15, David is about to return. He has set his invitation in order. He has appealed to those left in Jerusalem. His son is dead. The rebellion is over. But notice how David returns. He was in a city called Mahanaim. We're told that in the previous chapter. Verse 15, So the king returned and came to Jordan. And Judah came to Gilgal to meet the king, to conduct the king over Jordan. In other words, he moved all the way from Mahanaim down on the east side of the Jordan and crossed over the Jordan at Gilgal. Now that's immensely interesting, brothers and sisters. From Mahanaim to the bottom of the Jordan and across at Gilgal. Just keep your hand here and go over to Genesis chapter 32. David's experience parallels that of Jacob. Jacob began a most momentous trek into the promised land from the same place where David was. Genesis chapter 32. When Jacob is entering the land, just notice how Genesis parallels this experience. Verse 1. Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's host." And he called the name of that place Mahanaim, the very place where David fled to when he left Jerusalem, the place where he resided to receive the news of Absalom. Mahanaim, what does it mean? The margin shows us it means two hosts or camps, referring obviously to his camp and Esau's camp. But also it refers, no doubt, to the fact that the angels were with David as a great host, or rather were with Jacob as a great host. Now as we go through chapter 32, just notice when we come down to the end of chapter 32, that here in this very experience, Jacob is encouraged in the following way. The angel says at this point, verse 27, to Jacob. He said unto him, "What is thy name?" And he said, "Jacob." And he said, "Thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and hast prevailed." Verse 30. Jacob called the name of the place Peniel. "For I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved." And as he passed over Peniel, the sun rose upon him, and he halted upon his thigh. And Jacob goes down the Jordan and re-enters into the land. You see, David was in Mahanaim, and there the tide changed for David. He is about to finally be recognized once again as king and re-enter into his city. But his track parallels that of Jacob's. He is in Mahanaim, the very place where Jacob was. There Jacob received assurance that God's angels were with Jacob, and God was with Jacob through that angelic support. Jacob follows down from Mahanaim on the east side of the Jordan and re-enters the land. David and Mahanaim, despite the discouraging news of his son's death, follows down the same course of the east of the Jordan, no doubt remembering the significance of the place called Mahanaim, retracing the steps of Jacob, as Jesus was later to retrace the steps of David himself as he climbed from the Kidron up to the Mount of Olives to worship, just like David. But now Jacob, in this parallel with David, was a source of encouragement, no doubt, to David. His heart was rent, his son was dead, and he mourned for him. And yet he walks in the steps of Jacob, and he crosses at Gilgal, the place where Joshua crossed, where the nation was circumcised, where Jacob met an angel not far from that place, where Jacob was encouraged by the angel that victory was in his hands and he would conquer the land. Historical events and places, rich in their significance, were a source of encouragement, no doubt, for David. And David would remember that here, in this very place, God had said to Jacob, as he was now to say to David, that Israel is to be a prince. Israel is to have power with God because thou hast prevailed. Will David prevail? He will. Will God bless David? He will. The angels will encircle around David and encourage him and help him as he now re-enters the land under a fresh start. You see how God encouraged David once again. Grieved as he was for Absalom, he follows in the steps of Jacob and touches on those places, brothers and sisters, which were this great source of encouragement. Let's read those words again. "And Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved." Jacob returned halting. He was a man who had learned lessons, but he was lame as he re-entered into that land. And brothers and sisters, do we not see David that way? David has lost his son.
Grieving as he was, he is encouraged by God's angelic support. He returns a man like Jacob. He is lame in a certain sense. He halts back into Jerusalem, weighed down by his sins, by his failure, and the loss of his son. But by retracing those steps of Jacob, he is encouraged that he has seen God face to face in these precious promises and has the encouragement, as Jacob did, that victory will be his.